welcome to this edition of the Politically Incorrect Podcast. I'm Jim Williams, your host, along with my buddy Dan McDurry. And each week we come right here for conversation about what's going on in your government and around the world. And we try to enlighten and entertain you in the best possible way that we can. And Daniel, this week has been, you know, another chaotic one. But it wouldn't be Washington without chaos. And it just happened to be the same week that we celebrated the 18th anniversary of 9/11. And you have some interesting observations, which I think we could share with the crowd.
Well, one of the things about the remembrance of 9/11 is just is basically, you know, I think it started out with a good place, a good heart, people wanting to recognize the first responders who have lost their lives, also recognize what it meant to the country from a historical significant standpoint. And then, of course, it ended up leading into a great recession. So I think people, they want to remember, and I think that it's very important to always remember history, because if you don't, then you're doomed to repeat it, that old cliche. But I do think that, you know, over time, it's really become kind of like a Academy Awards show. You know, you've got the ceremony down there at Ground Zero, and all these politicians from yesteryears are showing up, and they're squabbling about how much stage time do I get? What story can I tell? When, you know, I remember when where I was when I got the call, and you know, where am I sitting? And I've got to be center stage, and no, I was supposed to be in front row, not second row. It almost seems like they're just kind of squabbling over petty type of things, especially when it goes into election years or close to election years, where, you know, that's one of the places, well, we just got to get them there. We got to get them. They got to get that exposure. They got to get their exposure. So I think it gets used and abused to a certain regard, the remembrance ceremony of 9/11. I also think that it really now, this year specifically, speaks to just how tribal the country is and how angry the country is. I happen to notice that one father of one of the victims of 9/11, first responders of 9/11, showed up wearing a T-shirt with the quotes taken out of context, of course, from Ilhan Omar, the representative from Minnesota. And she said, you know, something. She had, there's like a 90-second clip out there, but people are really grabbing on to the idea of, you know, some people did some things. I mean, that's what people are grabbing onto. Now, I'm not a fan of Omar. I've said that in the past. I think that she is too far left to represent the whole of the country and the heart of the country. I think that she, you know, plays to her base. I think that she's a disruptor. I think that she is, you know, part of the squad who isn't interested in waiting their turn and learning from, you know, the Democrat hierarchy and figuring out how to get good legislation passed. I think they're only there for certain reasons, and that's to be an agent of chaos. And, you know, we see that in Congress on both left and right. So I qualify it by saying that, but that statement really was taken out of context. I watched the interview of her. I heard what she said, and they're grabbing onto those words. You know, some people did some things. And I saw the victim's father wearing that shirt. And then she, of course, goes to DEFCON 1, where she sits down and you know, responds to him and responds to it, responds to what 9/11 means to her as a Muslim woman and all of these things, takes a video, throws it up on her Twitter and Instagram account. And it seems like, is that really what we want? 9/11 ceremony and the remembrance of what it was and the historical significance, that it basically is starting to boil down to, well, you can't possibly truly remember 9/11 properly and give people the proper type of sympathy if you are a Democrat, or you can't possibly understand the grief I went through on 9/11 because you're a Republican. I mean, is that really what it's becoming, Jim, where basically 9/11 now is some sort of form of purity test to see who's who and what's what, and you better be on my side?
Unfortunately, in some regards, I think you're right. One of the things, 9/11, I mean, obviously it was the largest loss of life that the U.S. has seen since the Civil War, and certainly on our soil, obviously more than even Pearl Harbor, which was the catalyst to get us into World War II. The thing that, I mean, the people who died in the towers, the people who died on the plane in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the people who died at the Pentagon, were Republicans and Democrats. They were progressive. They were conservative. They were, you know, there was everybody. Okay. The idea that you want to politicize this, or people would want to politicize this, is about as repugnant as you can get. And I agree with you. The problem of being tribal is that you don't see clearly through a lens. You see everything through a colored lens. And you see it only through the lens that you wish to see it through. And rather than doing what is proper, which would be to take a moment and remember what happened on that day, and, you know, understand the context and hope that we've grown and understood why this happened and hopefully why we can keep it from happening ever again, we move to our camps and unfortunately begin the process, as you say, of playing, I can be more a grieving person than you can because I have a better reason to grieve than you do, because your side doesn't grieve as well as my side because your side doesn't appreciate my side, and so therefore we don't grieve. I mean, we now have a large group of people in this country who weren't even born when 9/11 happened. We have others, a large portion of the population, who when 9/11 happened were, you know, either very small or in their teens. And so what in some regards is getting lost here is actually what happened on 9/11 and why it freaked the country and the world out, because it was the first time there was a systematic terrorist attack on U.S. soil that literally took down two of the most iconic structures in the country. It attacked one of what many would think the safest place to be during an attack, which would be the Pentagon. And then, of course, the combination of the bravery and, in some regards, the ineptitude of the pilots of what happened over Shanksville, Pennsylvania. So we have those three areas of the country, all who were part of 9/11, and people tend to not to remember as much what happened and why it happened as to, you know, spinning things for a political gain. But unfortunately, it seems as if, you know, doesn't matter what it is, it can be as deep and as important as the historic situations of what happened on 9/11, or it can be as absolutely absurd as taking a knee before the national anthem. And yeah, and that becomes, you know, flashpoints at this juncture. And you're right, the tribalism, I think, has gone to a point which certainly in my lifetime has never been like this. And I hope that we can find our way back, but it's not going to be an overnight situation, to be sure.
No, it's absolutely not. It's one of those things too, where people always say like, oh, what could be, you know, that one event that unites the country again, and unites people again. And it's like, well, the one event that could would have to be on the scale of like a September 11th. But yet, even when we're remembering September 11th, we can't even unite for that anymore. So that to me is one of the most disconcerting factors of it all, just showing that I don't really know if there is a way to unite the country completely and fully. I mean, I know people say like a world event or a tragedy or, you know, some sort of national disaster, but I don't think people have the attention span to really allow that to sink in and for them to understand what really took place. I also don't think that, you know, social media allows them to think about things that are bigger than just themselves. I mean, everybody's been so programmed now that they have their own accounts, they have their own content, they have their own, they're little mini content producers, they're kings themselves, they're celebrities themselves because of YouTube, because of Instagram, because of Twitter, because of all these things and all these different outlets, that people can't think bigger than just themselves anymore. They can't think bigger than just themselves. And I thought there was a really funny thing that took place. It was like a little social experiment that I conducted unbeknownst to the people in the room, or I should say the terminal, because I was flying out of Toronto, and you know, the guy gets on the intercom, the gate attendant gets on the intercom, and it's like, sorry, bad news, people. You know, we've got a full flight today, so please, if anybody would check their bags, that would be wonderful, and that would help us move along quickly, and then we wouldn't have to, you know, delay takeoff any longer. Mm-hmm. And so if you'd like to check your bags, please come up. And it was really kind of funny, because I'm looking around, scanning the whole room. And, you know, of course, me being an American, I was like, I'm not checking my bag. I'm not checking it. Why would I packed it. I packed an oversight. Why would I check? And so it instantly resorted right back to me, the American of no way, shape, or form. But then I started looking around. The Canadians, the Italians, like people who had, you know, flown mm-hmm. into this international airport, they all start like, oh, yeah, you know, they start shaking their head, like, yeah, that's reasonable, let's go. And they all start walking up there and start checking their bags. Not one American did. Not one American. Like, I'm sitting, I can hear them talking. I hear their language. I recognize accents. Mm-hmm. Not one American walked up there and checked their bag. While all the foreigners, you know, domestic or international, they all checked their bags instantly. They had no problem doing it. And they saw the reason and the logic for it, because the greater good had to prevail. Meanwhile, you had the Americans living just for themselves. And so I thought that was kind of an interesting thing to watch happen in real time.
No, it is. I mean, you know, by the way, just shameless plug, love Toronto and Montreal, two great cities out there.
Montreal's wonderful.
Yeah, so I, you know, highly recommend. But I've been in that airport a number of times. And more often than not, the people who are most polite to you are the folks who are from either Canada or just flown in from another country. You know, so... Hey, by the way, just out of curiosity, folks, for the record, the 20 people who were involved, as we do a little quick history lesson for you, in the 9/11 terror attacks came to the United States through Canada. They didn't come through the southern border. So if you want that wall, build it against Canada. I'm just kidding. I'm just saying. It's funny how you'll see that people tend to, you know, be a little bit more selfless than we are. Maybe not as much of a little bit as I should have just said, but no, we do. We do tend to think, well, you know, hey, this is the United States of America. We do everything better.
Okay? Yeah.
How dare them think that they can do better than we.
And it's not just that, though. I mean, I think that when you also think of what September 11th is, yeah. I mean, I knew when it happened, and, you know, the unfolding of and the backlash mm-hmm. of it, and, you know, everything that entailed after it, you knew that one day you'd wake up and you would be, you know, 18 years down the road. And of course, conspiracies would still be everywhere, you know, sure. Like, oh, the government actually blew the buildings up, because how did it blow mm-hmm. up and just fall directly and crumble within itself and not hit any of the remaining buildings? And all you knew you'd have to deal with that. What I never thought I'd have to deal with is the idea of this political fault line polarism, mm-hmm. which basically states, oh, hey, guess what? There's no way you could appreciate 9/11 like I could, because, you know, it affects us, the Republican Party, much more and much more greatly than it affects you. I never in my wildest dreams thought that would happen.
That would be tough to take. And you're right. I mean, it would be something. And, you know, the funny thing about it, and I mean funny, I obviously don't mean from a hilarity standpoint, but the strange thing about it is that at 9/11, when it happened, the world rallied around us, because they felt, if one of us are attacked, then we're all attacked. I don't think that's the way it goes anymore. I think that we, again, here in the United States, we don't project that if something happens in Europe or Asia or off the coast in Bermuda, that we rally quickly enough to help our neighbors or people, in some cases, who are halfway across the world, as much as they did for us on 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that that goes into kind of the international diplomatic process, and, you know, our ability to be a good ally. And, you know, the whole idea of how being a good ally kind of flies in the face of the mantra of America first. So I think mm-hmm. that kind of goes into that. By the way, what do you think about, you know, the report coming out that, you know, Trump, speaking of international diplomacy, what do you think about the report that President Trump is giving serious consideration to keeping Mike Pompeo as the Secretary of State, but also adding to his plate and making him National Security Advisor too? Now, that was done in the Nixon administration with Henry Kissinger, who ran both the State Department and the White House National Security Council, but that was 73. And as we know, and as people like to say, you know, it might have not been simpler times politically, because we all know what ended up happening with Nixon, but yeah, it was simpler times in 73 compared to things in the movements of the international community that we deal with today. And frankly, I think those two jobs for one person, just too big. It's impossible for one person to do that.
Tell you what, let's talk about that after we take this break. We'll be right back with more of the Politically Incorrect. Now, for those who speak English out there, we will be back with more of the Politically Incorrect podcast right after this. Welcome back to the Politically Incorrect podcast. I'm Jim Williams. Dan Maduri and I are here for your entertainment pleasure, and hopefully to inform you and give you a little history. So when last we left, the question on the board was, should Mike Pompeo, who is presently Secretary of State, assume the John Bolton role as National Security Advisor? The answer to the question is, let's see, how do we put this? Hell no. Of course not.
I would put it delicately.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I mean, what, are they crazy? No. You said Henry Kissinger, you know, under Nixon in 73 was the last to hold both positions. Look, Mike Pompeo is no Henry Kissinger.
Against Mike Pompeo.
No, not I don't want to throw shade, not throwing shade on Mike Pompeo. I think Mike Pompeo would say that he's not Henry Kissinger. That being said, you know, just before the break, you know, you said, well, you know, that was 73, and we now know. Now, we talked earlier about 9/11. You know, the whole, that whole position, you know, has become extremely more detailed and more important and more in depth than when Henry Kissinger held it. Not that it wasn't, you know, deep then, but it's much deeper now. And so, no, I don't see how any, you know, anybody, especially Secretary of State, is an incredibly important part of any government. That's number one. Number two, I don't see how you can be running around the world as Pompeo is wont to do, and actually it's kind of part of the job description, while at the same time taking care of what in essence is national security that also includes security within our own borders.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see how that works.
You just can't do it. I mean, one person can't do it, which brings up some interesting ideas about it, right? I mean, the part that comes about to me is immediately, if you're Pompeo, of course you're going to say yes, because that's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and you never say no to once-in-a-lifetime opportunities. But then what? How would you unpack that? How would you unroll that? Well, clearly then the next step is that you select which job you would rather have and which job you would rather have the information flowing through you personally, and you making absolute decisions and you making the call. And then you stagger it and you put someone else basically as like a co-CEO, like your Oracle or something, and have two CEOs rather than one CEO because it's just too big for one person. And now you have a person who wasn't appointed, didn't go through the vetting process, didn't get confirmed, and now they are basically this acting either national security advisor or acting secretary of state, and they're privy to all the information coming through there, and then they're the ones ultimately making recommendations to Pompeo, who then even brings it back to the president, or even worse yet, they're the ones bringing the recommendations to the president of the United States. So to me, that would be the most logical move for him to do, is you know, bring in a right-hand man or woman and say, this job is yours. It's too much. The two jobs are just too much for me. This one is yours.
Well, yeah, I mean, that seems to be something that you could do. And if Pompeo were offered the opportunity, it's probably something he would do. But, you know, it brings to point the lack of a bench that the Trump administration has when it comes to finding people to fill, you know, roles in the government. And I think that, I mean, we're talking right now about people in the West Wing. You know, it goes all the way out to ambassadors. We don't even have an ambassador in the Bahamas. We were just talking about the Bahamas prior to the break. I think it's the bottom line is that it's difficult to fill jobs in this administration.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, very scary and very disconcerting because, I mean, going back to Pompeo, so what if he screws up his job as national security advisor? Do you just fire him from that and he goes back to being just solely Secretary of State? What if he screws up Secretary of State? Do you fire him just from that and he just becomes just national security advisor? Do you have to fire him for both positions then? Do you then have to find two people that one person was doing? So it becomes like a hiring issue because now you've firmly entrenched a person in not one but two departments, two extraordinarily important departments, especially now with the way China's operating, the way Russia's on the move. And you see all of these different things happening. North Korea hasn't slowed down anything when it comes to Kim Jong-un being Rocket Man. And of course, you've got Iran, who is continuing to go forward with their nuclear program because the nuclear treaty was destroyed by Trump. So I think that, you know, you kind of evaluate that situation. It's terrible, but it goes back to you, what you were saying, about there is no bench. I mean, a couple of days ago, once Bolton either fired or resigned and then was fired, I mean, who knows what it actually was. I mean, that just shows you the petty and the squabbleness Bolton has and is and has become. But you also think about in the sense of, you know, when Bolton did whatever happened there, whatever took place there, you know, Trump apparently picked up the phone. The president apparently picked up the phone and called McMaster's and talked to him about it. And McMaster's wasn't interested in coming back, wants nothing to do with it. So now it almost seems like, and the last time, John Bolton was basically third on their list, was the only person who would take the job. So now it seems like these short lists that always get handed to a president, okay, this position opened up, here's a list of like five names, seven names. It almost seems like there are no lists anymore, that there's no one on the list. Like nobody wants it. I mean, if you believe what Petraeus said, General Petraeus, the disgraced general who slept with his ghostwriter or whatever it was, if you believe what he said that the administration called him, this was about 18 months ago, and that he told them that he had no interest working for the current leadership. So, I mean, you can't even dip into people who are reclamation projects and bring them back to life. And people who are very clearly very interested to get brought back to life into that world. So if you have that going on, and you can't bring in people who have maybe damaged reputations, but you know are good, thorough people, good, thorough, brilliant people, now you got a major problem. And now you're looking around saying, okay, well, who will work for me and how can we go about this and how can we do this? And that to me is very startling and very concerning because these departments are already hobbled with the fact that there are very little undersecretaries, if any, and so they don't have the infrastructure in these individual departments. And now you're going to start using people who are already in charge of one department and, you know, having them run two it makes no sense to me, and I don't see, if you're Pompeo, you almost have to accept, but you're also setting yourself up for extreme failure. You just are.
Yeah. I was just checking, and you know, Sheriff Joe Arpaio is still out there, so I mean, if if they need
what are
him,
we waiting for?
You know, what you know, God knows that President Trump has his cell phone number, so I'm sure that would be cool, you know, interesting. It's funny you're talking about Bolton from the standpoint of being fired or whatever. You know, the tweet came out saying that the president had gotten rid of Bolton, Bolton was seen at the White House. It actually, I think CNN and MSNBC had pictures, you know, video of Bolton standing outside the portico at the White House on his cell phone, and then going back inside. And he was asked by the press, you know, that he talking about him being fired. And he goes, well, no, I submitted my resignation to the president last night. And oh, by the way, no one fires me by tweet. If they can't fire me face to face, then it isn't firing. And I thought that was pretty telling, because, you know, the president has, for those of you out there who may or may not remember, when he did fire James Comey, Comey was in Los Angeles.
Trump sent
his body man, okay, which is, you know, for those of you who watch West Wing, that was Charlie. Charlie was the body man. He sent him out to L.A. to deliver a letter to Comey to basically say he was fired. Then the president got mad because Comey flew home on the same jet with the guy who took it out there to fire him. So
yeah,
it's like, okay. So what do you want him to do? Use his own frequent flyer miles to get home? It's like, okay.
Yeah, just show up to LAX and buy a ticket like everybody else. You know, so
right.
Go back,
yeah, it's
to
like
real quick, because I want you to think about this, and I want you to answer this, because I was thinking, you know, it is kind of amazing that, you know, you kind of run into these, you know, the generals of the world and you know, the political animals of the world. And when you boil them down to the surface, I mean, it really comes out of them that there truly is a patriotic thread that runs through all of them.
Mm-hmm.
It truly is the greater good of the country, whether it's Mattis, whether it's Petraeus, whether it's McMaster, you know, you truly feel that when you speak to them and when you talk to them. You truly get that from them. Sooner or later, it kind of comes out, and you realize the discipline they live their life by, and you know, it means something like that, more to that. So I asked the question, you know, when it comes down to the president not being able to fill these key positions within his administration, I mean, Petraeus is on record before, you know, during Trump's transition, before he was president-elect, but before he was president, he's on record saying, someone asked him, if Trump reached out to you, would you accept the position as an administration? He's on record saying that if it's for the best of the country, I would have, there's only one response you can have, and that's yes, Mr. President. That's what he said. He's on record saying, yes, Mr. President is the only response that an individual, that a patriot, that a commander could say, yes, Mr. President. Now, of course, the tune has changed. And so I wonder, does it say more about the people who are on the short lists that they're turning down the president of the United States? Or does it say more about the administration at large? Because the administration, clearly it's politics, right? I mean, it was just politics. But when you're on that short list, you believe in something bigger than whoever is occupying the Oval Office at that moment in time. And why has that changed, unless, of course, it's politics?
Yeah, I think it's probably administration. You know, there have been each person who comes into that role has their own, you know, idea or set of ideas that they want to run the show by. I think Petraeus, in his case, Petraeus served for both Republican and Democratic administrations. And I think that Petraeus, probably more than anyone in recent, probably Colin Powell would be another one, were pushed from the military side into the political side of it. So I think they got a taste of it and understood how that process was not necessarily to their liking. And so I think Petraeus, you know, looked at it and said, you know what, I'm going to take a pass here. And I think largely because, you know, it's kind of one of those things where you sit there and go, is this a good career move for me now? You know, I've got a legacy of that, you know, depending on who you think of and who you're thinking about, you either have great respect for them or you don't. But there is a legacy there. And I think that some of these people looking at that legacy and wait a minute, my legacy is pretty cool at the moment. I really don't know if I want to take a moment and tarnish it. And I think that part of this administration's downfall, if you will, has been that they've not been able to attract really good people. And then once they get them, they haven't been able to keep them. And I think that's a problem. It's not necessarily a problem that is just a Trump problem. It's happened to other presidents. But I think it's happened more to this administration, in large part because of the wrong-footedness that they got off to from day one. And I think that was kind of the problem. And I think that part of the issue at hand here is that when you work for a president who's very erratic and who doesn't necessarily play by the rules of former presidents, meaning structure and how things are done, you're in a position where you take something and you say, okay, I'm cool, this is what I'm supposed to do. Yet, in many ways, the president is taking you and telling you to do something totally different. And there's a kind of a jarringness there. It's kind of like if you're a football fan, it's like you sign up as a linebacker to play for a football team, and all of a sudden the coach says, "Now, you know what? I see that you're a pretty decent linebacker, but I need you to play free safety." It's like, I can't play it, but, you know, I'll do my best. And, you know, after playing out a position for a while, you sit there and go, you know what, this is not a good career move. And yeah. So I think that's it. And the other part is, you know, when you've got a president who deals in Twitter more than he deals in face-to-face, then again, it's yet another thing you have to deal with. So, I don't know that people are going to run to this, because at the end of the day, you know, you've got retreads like Barr and others, and Bolton, who just left, who aren't exactly doing anything to change that page of their history book, other than making it worse.
Yeah. Yeah, and I saw that you know, firsthand, because I had it on very good authority that you know, Jared Kushner, when he was looking to have prison reform done,
right,
he reached out to several prominent members of the African American community. One was from the Midwest, and had been working towards this for years and just years and years and years. But he's from the Midwest. He comes from a big liberal city. And Jared Kushner had known him for years, reached out to him, said, "Hey, I'm bringing in boldness. You got to be a part of this." And there was just major reluctance on his side, even though this is everything he's been fighting for years, to the point where he was like, "I got to take a time out. I got to think about it." And then he started calling some people, and one of those people happened to be my friend. And that's how it ended up working its way towards me. But a long story short is that it took him about like 2 weeks to just make the decision. And then he, I won't say reluctantly, but basically he put serious parameters on his involvement with it. And the moment that, you know, it got too hot in the kitchen, because he was working with Jared Kushner and the Trump administration on prison reform, for him to start disrupting his life back home, was the moment that he was just going to cut bait and walk away. And yet, this is everything that he's always wanted. Now, granted, he stayed through the finish. They got it done. It's a major cornerstone of this administration, and he is as happy as a clam. But the fact is that it took a lot of persuading on Kushner's part to get him into the fold and help, and have him help bring it across the finish line.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's kind of the way it ends up in many ways being for a lot of people in this administration. Is it You know, even under the best of circumstances, even with you, even if you feel that what Jared Kushner is doing is honorable, you have to take a second look and a third look and a fourth look to see if all the work that you do with Jared or any other member of the administration is going to be sabotaged in some way to make it look as if it was less than savory to begin with. So, you know, I think that that is a problem, and it will continue to be a problem with this administration. I mean, it's look, there's other, again, we can go back and look at others where there's been problems, but I do believe that part of the lack of discipline here is what causes people to have pause, is that, you know, maybe, as you said, your friend wanted to help Jared, but, you know, it's a matter of, you know, at the end of the day, is all the work that we do going to go for naught? If that's the case, then why are we even doing it? So, as you say, they did bring it across the finish line, and kudos on that one. But it does make it tougher to get these things done. I know that Chiara just lost recently one of the key members of his team that was working on Middle East peace, because, again, he felt that that they weren't moving in the right direction, and that despite the fact that for nearly 2 years they've been working on projects and trying to get to the, you know, get people to the table, he felt he no longer wanted to be, you know, part of that gang. So it does make it tough, that's for sure. You're listening to the Politically Incorrect Podcast. I'm Jim Williams. He's Dan Majori. We'll be back after this. Hey, everybody, let me tell you about my friends at Warby Parker. Now, they were founded with a rebellious spirit and a lofty goal to create boutique-quality eyewear at a revolutionary price. It was a collaborative effort between four close friends. Warby Parker was conceived as an alternative to overpriced and bland eyewear that's available out there today. Now, prescription eyewear shouldn't cost you more than a plane ticket or a brand new iPhone. By circumventing traditional channels and engaging with customers directly through their website and the retail stores, Warby Parker has been able to provide high-quality, good-looking prescription eyewear at a fraction of the price. Now, Warby Parker's aesthetic is vintage-inspired with contemporary twist. Every pair is custom-fit with anti-reflective polycarbonate prescription lenses, available exclusively through the Warby Parker website at retail stores. Glasses start at $95, including prescription lenses. And those lenses, by the way, include anti-glare and anti-scratch coating. Now, if you need blue light filtering for those lenses, they are also available at Warby Parker. Now, on personal experience, here's what happened, okay? I needed a new pair of glasses. So I went to Warby Parker's website. Now, I got to tell you, there is a tremendous amount of fantastic information about all kinds of glasses there. Whether you're a man, a woman, if you want sunglasses, it's all there. So you're at the website, and they also have a short test. Now, the short test gives you an opportunity to see what style of glasses looks best on your face by simply taking a short test. Doesn't take more than 5 minutes, okay? Once I did that, I then found out about the Game Changer, folks. The Game Changer is this. It's a free home try-on program. You order five pairs of glasses. You try them for 5 days. There's no obligation to buy anything. It ships to your house for free. And inside the box is included a prepaid return shipping label, so you can send those five glasses back after you've given them a try. So after I took my little test, I decided, okay, I'm going to go and find five glasses, you know, frames that I think would look good. And let's see what happens. So I went on. Now, like some websites, as I said before, they can be a nightmare. That is not the case with Warby Parker. The website, as I said before, tons of information, but very user-friendly and true to the style. So you know how you buy something on a website and it doesn't look anything when you get it like what you thought you purchased on the website? That is, again, not the case with Warby Parker. I went through and picked five frames that I thought would look good on my face. When the box showed up, I opened the box up And all five of the pairs of glasses looked exactly as they did on the website. So that was cool. Now, rather than, you know, when you're out looking at glasses in some of these stores, there's just walls and walls and walls and walls and walls of different frames, and it's overwhelming, and you pick something, you put them on, you give them to them, and you buy it, and you realize it later, it's okay, but it's not exactly what I wanted, but hey, you know, that's the way it is. It's not the way it is. If you do what I'm telling you with Warby Parker and do like I did and get those five pairs of glasses sent to your house and you got 5 days to look at them, what happens is this. I started off with five. I whittled it down to three. I took the three, I whittled it down to one and picked out the perfect frame for me. Now, I didn't do that by myself. I had help. Because I had that 5 days and those five different frames, I was able to get input from my family, my friends, my coworkers. I was able to wear them, around a little bit to look at them, to be able to get a feel for what they were like. And obviously they didn't have my prescription in it, but I was able to look at them in the mirror and even try on what did they look like with a suit or with a polo shirt or something like that. You're actually able to look at them in different ways that you can never do when you're rushed out, at a mall setting. Okay. So that was number one. Finally, I picked out, as I said, the ones that I felt were perfect for me. I went to the website. I went ahead and ordered the glasses. It was an easy process. I uploaded my prescription. Again, very simple. They also have a very cool camera, which allows you to take a picture, which then goes to them, which gives them the opportunity to perfectly fit these glasses to you. And then about a week later, bingo, the glasses show up. They are perfect. I have never in my life had a pair of glasses that looked better, that were more comfortable, or that I could see clearer from than these Warby Parker glasses. Hey, one last thing, folks, before I forget. If you happen to have an iPhone X, make sure to download the Warby Parker app where you can use their brand new virtual try-on, which allows you to try on the glasses, seeing the realistic color, texture, and size of each style by simply using your phone. Man, folks, I'm telling you, it is very cool and it's very, very fun to do, okay? So if you do have an iPhone X, like I do, quickly check out the download of Warby Parker's app. Just go to your, app store, download Warby Parker's app. It's free. Try on the eyeglasses, see the realistic color, texture, and size of each style, and you can do it right there on your phone. Folks, it doesn't get any easier than that, does it? Okay, so cool. So here's what I want you to do, because we got something that I really want you to get out there. Try that free home trial program, okay? Order five pairs of glasses. Try them on for 5 days. There's literally no obligation to buy. It ships free, includes a prepaid return shipping label. So head on over to warbyparker.com/mylastnamewilliams. That's warbyparker.com/WILLIAMS and order that free home try on today. And again, let's go right back to that. warbyparker.com/mylastnamewilliams. All that information is going to be in the show box. And again, Warby Parker, warbyparker.com/mylastnamewilliams, WILLIAMS, warbyparker.com/Williams. Order that free home try-on today. You'll be glad you did. I'm telling you, I was glad that I did because I love my Warby Parker glasses. And you will too. Welcome back to the Politically Incorrect Podcast. I'm Jim Williams. Dan Maduri with me here. Dan, we've got some final thoughts here. Let's go out on some good notes. I'll give you my final thought first to give so that can put you in a mindset here. I know that everybody out there is excited and geared up and geeked up about politics, but I saw the trailer the other day for Ford versus Ferrari, and it's a film with it's a film with Matt Damon, and it's coming out in November. And as someone who's a big sports car racing fan. I got a big kick out of it, and I thought to myself, you know what? We need a little bit of diversion from time to time. And I looked at that, watched the trailer, and said, you know what? I don't know what the hell the state of affairs is going to be in November of this year, but if the world is still here, and I'm hoping that it is, then I'm going to go see that film. So, you know, you take your respite where you can get it. So that's what I decided. You know what? I think sometimes we need to step away from, you know, the watching the news or reading the newspaper, pick up a book or check, you know, watch a movie or watch a TV show or something, because sometimes, you know, you get so sucked into this that it can be difficult. So yeah, I was looking at the trailer for the for Ford versus Ferrari, and I had a friend who saw it at the speaking of Toronto earlier at the Toronto Film Festival, and said that it's probably one of the best movies he's seen about auto racing in years, you know, all the way back to perhaps Steve McQueen's type films that he shot back in the late 60s and early 70s.
It looks great. It absolutely is great. I saw the trailer a while back, and it looked absolutely great. And actually, it rubbed me the wrong way in the sense that it looks so good, and it's got Christian Bale and Matt Damon in it, as you mentioned. But I don't like Matt Damon as an actor. And so when I saw this, I was like, I can't believe I got to go see a Matt Damon movie, because I have to see it. I mean, it looks wonderful, right. And it looks and feels as if it's going to be good. But part of my final thoughts is that we found a strange alien world that apparently has water vapor and rain clouds, meaning that there's water on this world. And it's an exoplanet, K218b, and it lies in the habitable zone of its own host star, some 110 light years away, which in the grand scheme of, you know, the universe or the galaxy, is basically right in our backyard. So I always said to you, Jim, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but there's a lot of, hey, guess what? We found this alien thing or that alien thing. there's so much to tune that the New York Times legitimately ran a story about an unidentified flying object that the Navy came in contact with. The first time the New York Times had ever run an alien type story, to the point where I don't know if somebody's conditioning us to get ready for something, but it just seems like, you know, with all the incredible things that these billionaires are doing with space and space travel, and now some of these satellites are getting as farthest out of the new known universe as ever before, that we're coming across a lot of interesting things. And, you know, frankly, space travel, as they say, the final frontier. So it'd be very interesting to see how this develops.
Well, folks, I'll tell you what, if you're not one of the over 25,000 people who've taken the time to subscribe and listen to our podcast, first of all, shame on you. You can find us because we're free on iTunes, because we're part of the Apple Podcast family. Same thing goes over at Google, because we're part of the Google Podcast family. You can find us on Spreaker, Stitcher, Spotify, as well as TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and YouTube, to name a few. If for some reason you can't find us, go out to the old Google machine, type in Politically Incorrect Podcast, hit the favorite button or the subscribe button, and each week you get a brand new edition of the podcast directly sent to your phone, your tablet, or to both. So please go out there and subscribe today. So, Daniel, let's talk about social media, and where can people find you on social media?
Just at Dan Maduri across the board.
All right. Find me on Twitter at JW Media DC. That's JW Media DC on Twitter. And Instagram, it is JimWilliams200. JimWilliams200 on Instagram. Folks, thanks very much for joining us on this edition of the Politically Incorrect Podcast. I'm Jim Williams for Dan Maduri. We'll see you next week. And God willing, we'll be able to chat about something that interests you as much as it interests us. Okay? Until that time, have a wonderful and safe weekend.